This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty.
Opportunities.
Part of the community.
The next idea.
The culture for innovation is a culture with a sense of destiny, a sense of that tomorrow is going to be better than today. That's what the word progress means.
The keys to a successful future for Michigan include turning out graduates with the skill sets to fill the jobs of the future and increasing access to post-secondary education for low-income, first-generation, and underrepresented students. The upcoming Michigan Pre-College and Youth Outreach Conference will explore these challenges, focusing on the urgency of college access. The keynote speaker at this 10th annual conference is Jamie Kassab. He's the global education evangelist for Google, and Jamie is with us. Now, welcome to The Next Idea.
Thank you for having me.
What is an education evangelist?
So I've been at Google for 12 years, and the entire time I've been at Google, I've been talking about education and the role that technology plays in education. So an evangelist is someone who brings good news, and I think that there are some really good news in the future of education and how technology can play a role in that.
And when we know that this conference that you're going to be keynoting is focusing on the urgency of college access, I know you were one of those low-income first-generation kids who used education, and you got out and moved up. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so this is where my passion for education comes from, is because I believe that education is what disrupts poverty. I believe that education can change a family's destiny in just one generation, and I'm living proof of that. And there's millions of people who are like me who can also prove that. I was born and raised in Hell's Kitchen, New York, and not the Hell's Kitchen that you find today with all the great restaurants, but the one from the 70s and 80s where it wasn't a nice place to grow up. And I saw the common denominator of people who were successful being education. So I focused on doing my schoolwork and graduating from high school and going to college and going to graduate school. And I'm doing today what I'm doing because of education, right? That's the power that education has. You can do this in one generation. But more importantly, my kids are okay, right? So I have three kids, and my daughter is 25 years old, and she's living in New York City right now, working at her dream job, and it's because of my fourth grade teacher, my ninth grade teacher. And so that's the real power that we have with education, is that we can change families' lives in just one generation.
And we stop and realize you're the son of a single mother who was an immigrant.
Yeah, so my mother came from Argentina, escaping poverty and government oppression in the late 60s, and I was born and raised in New York, and, you know, I grew up on welfare and food stamps like many people did back then, and I saw lots of people struggle through that, and so I think that given the opportunity to get a good education is the most critical thing that we can give, especially for immigrants who are coming to this country.
And how can technology, Jamie, help to reach those students, bring them in the fold, as it were, and help them to that post-secondary education that changed your life?
Yeah, so at the core of this is the ability to access information, right? So when I was growing up and living in Hell's Kitchen and I had to do a book report, I had to go to the Columbus Library on 51st Street and 10th Avenue. That's where my information was. That's where all my resources were. And it closed at 5 o'clock in the afternoon, and basketball practice went to the 4:45. It wasn't open on the weekends. And if I could find that book through that card catalog machine that we had, where you can have to memorize a 17-digit number because everyone stole the little pencils, I had to go find that book, and there's a good chance that book wasn't there because it wasn't my library, right? It was everyone who lived in Hell's Kitchen, everyone who went to PS 17 and PS 51 and all the schools in the neighborhood. That is no longer true. I have 100 million Columbus libraries at my fingertips, and that changes everything. So this gives us an opportunity to really live up to this idea that information equals education. And if we have access to all the information, then we can really change education. And so that at the core is where I think technology can play a huge role in learning.
I know you've often said we need to really realize that the future of education is right now. And we also need to rethink the way we educate and stop asking kids, what do you want to be when you grow up? Why is that?
Yeah, so it's one of those. So I talk to students all the time. I actually teach, besides my role at Google, I teach 10th grade communication at the Phoenix Coding Academy in Phoenix, Arizona. And I talk to students on a constant basis, and I ask them all the same question. And kids, as young as fifth grade, will answer the question when I ask them, you know, do your parents or has anyone ever asked you what you want to be when you grow up? And every single hand goes up. because that's what we're used to doing. We're used to asking kids what they want to be when they grow up, without the realization that we don't know what the future holds, right? 60% of the jobs in the future don't exist today. We're constantly recreating new jobs. Automation, robotics, machine learning, cloud computing will be impacting all jobs. And so that question makes no sense anymore. So I want to ask students, what problem do you want to solve? What's the problem that spins in your head? And the more important question is, what do you need to learn to solve that problem? What are the knowledge, skills, and abilities that you need to solve that problem? And that gets us really close to the things that are critical that motivate all of us, right? Which is purpose, autonomy, and mastery, which Daniel Pink talks about in his book Drive.
Yeah, and if that's spinning in your head and it enchants you and draws you, then you're not really working as you pursue that career path.
Right. And here's the thing. It's the process of problem solving. If you ask employers all over the world, what's the number one skill you want your employees to have? And overwhelmingly, the answer is problem solving skills. And so how do we teach problem solving skills? So even if a fifth grader or a ninth grader says, I want to solve the problem of making cars go faster, it's the process that they learn of problem solving, right? No matter what the problem is, there is a methodology that you use to solve that problem, and that's what we need to focus on.
In thinking about the future of education and what it should be in Michigan to build a strong economy for this state and turn out the graduates who can help Michigan's companies grow, what are the questions that we should be asking?
First of all, I think what's happening in Michigan is fantastic. I've watched Michigan over the last 20 years, and it's very similar to what I grew up like in New York in terms of like, oh, this is, you know, the place is going into the dumps, and now there's this whole realization of new buildings and new businesses moving to Detroit and other places. So it's exciting to see, because I went through the same thing in New York. New York was in the dumps, and then in the 90s and in the 2000s, it went up. So that's great. So now we need to continue that in all our states. And the most important thing that we can do, and you just mentioned this, is not think about the future of education as something that we have to plan for 20 years from now, but literally the future of education, the future classroom starts on Monday. And what we need to do in the education world is give teachers the space to experiment, to try different things, to really take advantage of what they know. Because I've worked in workforces across spectrums, right? So I've spent 7 years at Accenture, and I worked in electronics and high tech and finance and banking and credit cards. I worked in government for 2 years, and there is no more passionate and dedicated group of a workforce than teachers. And so if we can give them the opportunity to show us what they can do, I think we'll see amazing things.
And this tool of technology, how should we be using that tool in the classrooms of the future?
Yeah, so let's start with this idea that it's not just about putting technology into our school systems. It's not just about putting machines into our school systems, because if we don't change the models, all we're doing is making the old education model faster and more efficient. What we need to do is take the best of what we know good education is, take the ideas of what we know good education are. We know what good education looks like. We know that education has to be relevant and engaging and personal. We know these things. And so what we need to do is ask ourselves, how do we bring these ideas to life? How do we use technology to bring these ideas to life? And if we start with that conversation, we'll create what the future of learning looks like.
Jamie Kassup is the Global Education Evangelist for Google and is the keynote speaker at the 10th Annual Michigan Pre-College and Youth Outreach Conference. It's happening next Monday at the Michigan League on the campus of the University of Michigan. Jamie, thank you so much. It was great to have you as a part of the Next Idea.
Thank you very much for having me.
Support for the Next Idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.
Think about those moments when it seemed pretty much the whole nation was gathered around the TV set. The moon landing in 1969, a Super Bowl, a hit TV show, these days maybe Game of Thrones. My next guest believes it's that time in front of the TV that might be the secret weapon that helps future space travelers handle those ultra-long voyages. Jan Vandenbulk is a professor of media psychology at the University of Michigan. Welcome. Great to have you here.
Great to be here.
So we know one day a manned spacecraft is going to blast off for deep space exploration, and those are going to be the first humans ever to deal with not seeing the Earth.
Right.
and years of travel with not a lot to do until you get to your destination. What do we know about what that might do to behavior and thoughts?
I think up until now, any space mission has involved a lot of work. But when we reach out to something like Mars, it's going to be a lot of waiting. And it's not just waiting. There won't be any point of reference. You know, day and night won't make a difference. Mondays and Wednesdays won't make a difference. So that's what made me think, okay, is there something in our psychology that helps us distinguish between morning and noon and between Sundays and Thursdays? And that's how I started thinking, yeah, the media used to do that. They don't do it so much anymore because now we have DVD boxes and streaming video. But before, noon was a certain radio show that came on. And the evening, you know, you weren't supposed to, or at least when I grew up, you weren't supposed to watch television until after a certain show came on. And so those little things told us what time of day and even what day of the week or what time of the year it was.
So it gives a sense of structure.
Structure, exactly.
But there are those TV moments when it seems, you know, I remember setting the alarm to get up for the royal wedding, things that pull us together.
Yes. So that's a weird phenomenon because, like, if you study something like audiences, media audiences, or the audience of this show, it's all individuals at home listening to the radio, watching television. They're not in the same room together, and it still creates a bond. And a bond comes from experiencing something big at the same time. Again, something that's lost now that we have streaming video and that you can watch it in the morning and I can watch it 2 years from now. But there used to be a time that if you wanted to see something or hear something, you had to be there together with everybody else.
I almost think that when I reference Game of Thrones, because I'm a huge fan and it's like an incredibly popular show, which they release globally because of the spoiler alerts. Like, you had better watch that episode on Sunday because you can bet on Monday everybody's going to be screaming about the Red Wedding. So we still kind of have that experience.
Yes, certainly. And it still has that effect on us. And I think that's why we feel so bad about spoilers. Or another weird phenomenon is, it doesn't apply to everyone, but there's a lot of people, if you record a sports program, you know, you're probably not going to watch it because it's not live. You're not there while it's happening. Well, you weren't going to be there anyway because you were going to watch it from home. But it does something to us.
Or you're my husband who records Manchester United, has it, and then, God forbid, he sees anything that lets him know. He hides from the internet. He will not listen to sport. He does not want to hear the score, and it ruins it. So he can watch it as if it was brand new, but he has to go to great lengths.
Well, and that's one of the fascinating things about the media, because sometimes when you study media, people think, well, you know, media are trivial, so, you know, studying it must be trivial. Now, what I do may be trivial, but the media aren't trivial because it's such a large part of our lives. Look at all the trouble we have staying away from Facebook at night or not answering any emails. You know, there's so many ways in which they're part of our lives that we need to be aware of it.
So how would this, do you see, play out in, let's say, a flight to Mars?
There's a couple of peculiar aspects about media use in general that I think are illustrated by this example. One is heritage maintenance. You know, if you're from, say, Korea, and you're in a team with mainly Americans and Russians, part of you is going to want a connection with where you're from. That's what immigrants have always done. You know, they're interested in their home media because they want to keep that connection to their culture. At the same time, every immigrant has always looked for stuff that connects him or her to the new culture. So finding stuff that's communal will be another thing. I think the best example is probably many families. There was a time when we only had one TV set. And so we gathered in front of the TV set, and that was part of family life. Then, one of my professors said, then we invented central heating, and all of a sudden, we didn't have to be together anymore. But anyway, at some point, everybody had a TV set in his own or her own bedroom, and that sort of tore families somewhat apart.
Splintered.
But you'll still see that for some things, they will still come together and watch something together. Even though a lot of us feel that that's passive behavior, it's still doing something to us. It's creating a kind of bond by being able to watch something together and maybe joke about an actor or comment about something that's happening. It's a very simple way of creating a tiny community. There's not much cause for conflict with that kind of stuff. and you don't need to move. I mean, you can do it when you're scooped up in a little tin can.
I hear you saying, if you stream networks, let the crew watch Big Bang Theory all together. So we're talking about recreating something they know at home and also still having that context. Then.
Right, and of an older era, in a sense, because sometimes when you read about the psychology of space travel, they'll say, well, you know, they'll be bored, so send plenty of DVDs and books along. I think that's not enough, because the media can do much more than that. If you recreate that old way of watching television, Tuesday becomes the day that the next episode is going to be available. If it's something we watch together, that's going to be our day to watch the next episode of whatever it is. Not because we have it on a DVD and you've already seen it and I'm going to binge watch it tomorrow. So the old way of interacting with the media, I think, adds something to at least that situation.
So your advice would be to NASA, what would it be?
Well, make sure, I mean, all the guys up there and all the girls up there are going to be really good with computers, so they'd be hacking the system if you're not careful. But make sure they have that access to media that helps structure the day.
So stream the broadcast and cable networks, stream radio.
Yeah, that kind of stuff. And maybe even sort of reduce what the technological possibilities of today are. For instance, make it more difficult to record something or to watch it with some kind of delay. So now I'm forced to acknowledge that it's Thursday, and it's Thursday, 5 o'clock on Earth, at least the place we come from. And that's what anchors us. I'll give you another example. The media have always played a large role in defining seasons. It's the Christmas season. You see that because television is telling you all the time. Adverts are telling you. Movies are telling you. So that's telling us another year has passed. Another thing that you will have trouble with when you're isolated somewhere, whether it's on the North Pole or on a space mission, that's these old little things. Like today you can watch a Christmas movie whenever you like, of course. But there was a time when the whole culture, the media culture, was telling us what time of day it was, what day of the week it was.
And the payoff, I'm sure, once the crew comes home, would be they haven't been disconnected from Earth for all these months or years.
A big effect of the media is telling us, you know, in a very indirect way, but it's telling us about fashion, about changes in language. I studied in England for a while. You can tell that the British language is evolving as a result of watching so much American stuff on television. You know, those kinds of changes, which are implicit. Nobody's telling you, okay, from now on, we're not saying bloke anymore. We're saying guy like the Americans do. Nobody's telling you that. But you get a sense of that by being exposed to media. So that kind of connection to Earth would remain that way. The other example is prisoners. It's one of the reasons why some prisoners like the media. It keeps them, you know, fashion changes, cars look different, the way people talk to each other looks different. Look at an old movie about the Romans. People have sideburns, not because the Romans had sideburns, but because actors in those days had sideburns. And those little signals is what we get from the media.
Interesting stuff. Jan van den Bulk is a professor of media psychology at the University of Michigan with the secret weapon for deep space travel. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Still to come after the break, we'll meet a prisoner whose life was turned upside down by suicide. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio.